My guest today is Peter Ford. For years, Peter Ford admits that he was living a double life. By day, he was a reporter and an anchor for CNN. He was a globally recognized face, and he reported from some of the biggest stories in the world. And then, by chance, one day, around the CNN office, he got interested in this new science of computer programming. In 2 weeks, Peter Ford wrote software to control a bionic arm. And even though his bosses at CNN had forbidden him to continue, he could not stop himself, and he kept programming in secret. Peter's work caught the attention of a technology research institute in the States, and he learnt more. And all that moonlighting eventually led to the creation of NeuroSwitch. NeuroSwitch is simply a device to help people who are profoundly disabled to communicate. People with motor neuron disease or quadriplegia who are effectively locked into their own bodies. NeuroSwitch allows these people to communicate to the whole world by operating a laptop, just operating it by the tiniest twitch of a muscle. Peter perfected it with the advice of the world's most famous motor neuron disease patient, Stephen Hawking. Peter Ford came into the studio last week and he hooked me up to his device. He slapped on a small round adhesive patch under my forearm, and this patch was connected to a little unit round about the size of a couple of cigarette packets, and that sat on my lap. The patch was able to pick up the tiniest little muscle twitch in my arm when I moved one of my fingers. I'm just moving up my finger quite lazily now, and it's making the computer go beep like that.
Yeah. Now that beep, that's a payday beep. Imagine, if you will, that you can't move or speak, but we found one muscle somewhere that you can just send a signal down to, and it will flinch in some way, just enough to create a potential drop along the muscle. And that's what we're picking up with the sensors. If you can do that, and you can get that beep sound, you can now control everything on an Apple computer. Text, email, internet, text-to-speech, so it'll speak for you. And you can do anything on this computer that anyone can do with a keyboard and mouse.
This is done with a muscle twitch.
Exactly. One of the best bits of real estate is the forehead, the frontalis muscle, because it usually stays pretty much unimpeded by motor neuron disease or spinal cord injury or a number of other things. We have a guy in Tampa, Florida named Michael Phillips who has a thing called spinal muscular atrophy. He's quadriplegic. He breathes through a vent. He can't speak, and he raises and lowers his eyebrows, and he can play World of Warcraft running and gunning and wins.
How can you do something so complex and so quickly? Because what I'm seeing here is something that's a simple on-off switch, isn't
exactly.
it?
Exactly. So let's have a look at what you can do with that on-off switch. This is a demo program. Now if you make a signal.
Oh, I just booted up a keyboard.
Now you'll notice, if you make one signal, you'll notice the highlighted rows on the keyboard start to scan down. This is called scanning technology. When you get to the bottom row, make one signal. Now when it comes across, the next time it's going to come back again, make another signal now.
Hello. How are you?
Let me do that again.
Hello, how are you?
Within 5 to 10 steps, fairly easy ones, you can get to pretty much anywhere on the computer and launch pretty much any program and start doing things with the program.
So essentially what it does is, since it's all just yes, no, it shows you the whole world and says which half of the world you want to go to. You pick one half, then half of that, and the next thing you know, you're down like to the finest grain of sand, I suppose,
you
aren't
are.
You?
What you're describing is very clever. That's exponential leveraging, and we actually have a patent on that. But you'll notice when you scan down the keyboard, if you can imagine a keyboard in your head, and you see the top line of the keyboard is highlighted, and then it moves down one row, so the top row becomes unhighlighted, the next row becomes highlighted, and you select the row you want, and then it starts to scan from left to right in blocks. It'll go, maybe three keys will be control keys. The next slot might be command keys. The next slot might be arrow keys. And once it goes to the block you want, you make another signal. And then it starts to cycle through the keys inside that block on that row. And when you get to the key you want, you make the third signal. And it will launch whatever you want. A letter, a word, a preset phrase. And it will say that phrase out loud in a voice you choose.
And that's when you can get it to say,
thank you.
Somebody who has probably had to give up a lot of control, and they've lost their voice. When they get a voice back, the one they choose is a very important element for their identity. And then being able to control that and communicate changes their whole outlook on their existence. We have a client in Silicon Valley who has motor neuron disease. He's quadriplegic, has a ventilator through a tracheostomy, and can't move or speak. And he says when he communicates with his family in the room, they know that he's talking to them through this system, through using NeuroSwitch and the voices. When he goes on to Twitter and Facebook and the web, he's himself again. You know, as the old saying, nobody knows you're a dolphin when you're on the internet. So he resumes his old identity and becomes himself again, which is a remarkable recovery for somebody who's been told that's all going away.
I suppose necessarily we immediately think of the effect this has on the person with something like motor neuron disease who've been locked in. But it also must have a profound effect on the family and friends of that person who've been getting yes-no answers from someone they love dearly for years.
That's a really good point. And in fact, that's something that I didn't expect when we first started doing this because I was focusing on the patient and the outcome. But in fact, the first surprising response we had was from wives and carers and children who say that the stress level in the house has gone down because everyone can communicate. That big membrane between them has been removed.
How are you using this technology to allow people to control robots?
That's a good question. There's a company in Silicon Valley called Anybots, and Chris Griffith, who's the lead technology writer for The Australian, wrote a piece on them. And I read the article and called Chris up and said, look, I think we can control these things with neural signals, with neuromuscular signals. And so he came over to my office in North Sydney, and we wired him up, and we patched him into a robot on the floor of a factory in Silicon Valley. And he drove it around the floor, then he drove it outside down the sidewalk and brought it back inside and had a great time doing that. And then I went over to the States and I worked with VA hospitals, Veterans Administration hospitals, and wired up a U.S. Navy veteran who was quadriplegic. We put sensors on his arm in Tampa, Florida, and he drove a robot in Silicon Valley and drove it in real time. And the robot sends back pictures of what it sees and sends pictures from his computer to the robot. So anybody who's standing near the robot, if it rolls up to him and he can control it with nerve signals, he can then make it say, hello, how are you, the way you just did. And the person on the factory floor who's used to having robots walk up and say hello because they build robots there, says hello back. So they have a conversation. And the person at the other end, talking to the robot, doesn't necessarily know that the person controlling the robot with whom they're having the conversation is quadriplegic or locked in. So suddenly you're projecting your personality not just onto the internet, but into a three-dimensional space on somewhere else on the planet and having a conversation.
Okay, let's trace the rise and rise of inventor broadcaster Peter Ford now. Peter, you grew up on a farm in Miles in Western Queensland. Were you a tinkerer as a kid?
Always, yeah.
What kind of things did you make?
Well, I started by pulling things apart, alarm clocks, washing machines, and that soon ran into trouble. So anything mechanical. And my father was a great collector slash hoarder, depending on how you look at it. And he used to go to sales and buy all kinds of strange things. He'd go to the dump with a truckload of stuff and come back with a truckload of different stuff. And one of the things I found in there was some old wooden wall phones. You know the old phones where you crank the handle and speak, and you hold the mouth, the earpiece to one ear, and then you speak into the mouthpiece on the wall. And I found these in the shed, and for some reason just understood how they worked and got some batteries and some 8-gauge fencing wire and strung them across from various buildings in the farm and started a little telephone system. And realizing that would work made it easy to move on to other things.
Tell me about the bird trap you invented.
All right. There's a character who used to write cartoons for The New Yorker called Rube Goldberg. And he used to draw these really complex little devices that might end up doing something really simple, but in a really complex way. Like if you wanted to turn a light switch on in the apartment, he might have to pull a string over in the other end of the apartment and it poured some sand into a cup and the cup dropped down a slide and the slide tipped over. And
right, like the game of mousetrap.
Exactly.
Kind of thing, yeah.
Exactly. And they used to be called Rube Goldberg devices. I thought this was great. So I used to build bird traps that really the simple end was you drop a box over an unsuspecting rooster or chook by pulling a stick out. But in the process, you know, all these other things would go on, pulleys and devices and drops. And
how old were you when you were doing that?
About 5 or 6. And really? My mother used to rouse on me for trapping the chooks out in the yard and had to let them loose.
Now, what were your options then when you finished high school out in the Darling Downs of Queensland?
Well, we didn't have high school in Miles. We only went to grade 8. So I went to Brisbane, went to Churchy for 4 years to high school. And by various degrees of preconditioning and propaganda, was planning on doing medicine.
What do you mean by propaganda? Whose propaganda?
I think my old man wanted me to be a doctor. He thought that was a good profession.
Did he put that to you in a way that was going to brook no dissent from you?
Pretty much, yes.
Did you want to do medicine, though?
I believed I did at the time, largely because it was an easy course to follow. And I thought it was interesting. You know, it was the human body is just another big invention that you can tinker with in one sense.
So how did you discover you wanted to be a journalist instead of a doctor?
Well before grade eight, so I was still almost preteen. I read pretty voraciously as a kid, and I really always wanted to be Ernest Hemingway. So I'd really planned on being a journalist and going off and being a correspondent the way he was and then writing best-selling books.
I'm just amazed you're getting cartoons from The New Yorker and Ernest Hemingway books out in Western Queensland in those days.
Yeah, well, actually, I think I can thank my mother for that. We had a pretty rich intellectual life. We also had ABC Radio, which is one of the stalwarts. I mean, Arch McCurdy introduced me to jazz. And he introduced me to Thelonious Monk and Miles Davis and, you know, all the greats. So that was rich in itself, just thanks to ABC. But also, Mum always had stacks of books for us to read.
You went to the United States as an exchange student in that really signal year of 1968.
Yeah.
What did that do for you? What did that open your eyes to?
That 68 was a tumultuous year for America at all levels.
Bobby Kennedy was assassinated. Martin Luther King was assassinated.
Tet had occurred earlier in the Vietnamese New Year. That was a massive hit for the Americans and the Allies, us. That was an astonishing shift in American confidence.
Were you aware of all this while you were there?
Yeah, I was. And in fact, it's probably where I was really finally shifted over to journalism, because in those days, we take live television for granted now. We take 24-hour news for granted. But back then, the news was 15 to 30 minutes at night at 6 o'clock. You had Walter Cronkite for CBS, who was considered the most trusted man in America. When Walter Cronkite went and interviewed the generals in Vietnam and came back and reported on CBS News that the war was essentially unwinnable, Nixon, who was still a candidate at that point, knew he had lost the war. Johnson knew he had lost the war.
Then you came back to do national service. How did you like that?
I loved it. I had the best time. And for veterans who are listening who have been in combat, and I have not been in combat in uniform, that's going to be a mixed comment, because many of the vets who went into Vietnam, for example, came back with significant issues, not of their own making, but things that have affected the rest of their lives. I was, in that sense, fortunate because I went to Skyville, got a commission, and the week we were graduated as junior infantry officers, Gough Whitlam was voted in and stopped the war. And at the time, with the, you know, the view of youth, we were disappointed because we thought we were going to miss the big event. As it turned out, we were probably remarkably fortunate. But my experience in a battalion after that, I was 1 year with 3RAR, was just an outstanding time. I had the best time.
So you defied your dad and decided to become a journalist. How did he take that?
Well, it started when I dropped out of first year med. I failed every subject in medicine, first year medicine, except history, which is virtually impossible to fail. And my mother, you know, 50 years later, still tells the world she was devastated, and I don't think she's forgiven me. She says she has, but I don't believe her. And I think it was so bad. If you failed first year medicine back then, you couldn't repeat. I think for my efforts, if I'd had kids and they wanted to go in, they wouldn't be allowed to even start medicine. So it was a pretty significant event as far as I'm concerned. And drew the line under all that. So was then free to go off and do what I probably really wanted to do and should have done.
How did you become a journalist? How did you start up?
I always write for things. Like when I was an exchange student in the States in 68, I was writing for the local newspaper in Chinchilla. So I started writing for them. And then later on, I started writing for magazines and then went to the Warwick Daily News. So I wanted to spend a year with a newspaper.
So fast forwarding through your journalist career in Australia, then you went right up, became a television reporter presenter with Channel 7.
Yep.
And then CNN. I mean, this is this meteoric rise.
Well, I had a plan. I had a five-year plan.
You had a plan?
Yeah. I had a five-year plan. I wanted to do a year with the newspaper. That was Warwick Daily News. I wanted a year in radio to do voice work and learn to get on a mic. And that was with 4WK in Toowoomba. Then I got a job at Channel 7 almost straight away and did news there for about a year and then decided it was time to go and make the big jump.
To America?
Mm-hmm.
Was CNN your plan?
No. I'd actually written to the presidents of ABC, CBS, NBC, and this newfangled network called CNN.
And who responded?
What was really cool was the president of CBS and ABC in America got their vice presidents of news to write back to me and said, if you come to New York, we'll show you around. They didn't offer me a job. I wasn't looking for a job overtly. They said they'd show me around. So I had several days in New York being shown around what were then the leading newsrooms on the planet. and you know, sitting on the news meetings, on the editorial meetings, and then going into the control room and to watch the news go to air with anchors who are the most famous people in the country. And then went down to Atlanta for one afternoon, and the foreign editor, who is a very impressive woman named Janae Von Essen, saw me come in the front door, and she said, "I know you." And I said, "No, I've never been here before." She said, "Yeah, we've used your reports." CNN was so hungry for content. They were taking everything from every English language outfit in the country, in the world, rather. And so anything Seven put up, CNN would take on a deal. And so when I walked in, she said, "What are you doing here?" I said, "I want to look at satellites." She said, "You want a job?" I said, "Sure."
That's all it took.
And that was it. It's a bit harder these days.
So what was your role in the CNN juggernaut then?
When I hired on as a news anchor with CNN, the purpose being that I would go to CNN 2, which became Headline News, as soon as they were built. And there was a guy called Ted Kavanaugh, whose nickname was Mad Dog. He used to carry a .38 pistol in his ankle holster at work. Ted looked like Groucho Marx and was a force to be reckoned with in television news in the States. And he was probably one of the few guys who could start a brand new network from literally pouring the concrete to getting the satellite dishes up to transmitting in 3 months. And so Ted hired me on to eventually do that. And we were there when they were pouring the concrete and then went to air as what is now Headline News.
You were a reporter for a while, and for 3 years you covered the Ku Klux Klan, such as it was in those days.
Yeah.
3 years. What did you learn about that strange organization over that time?
Hate, bigotry, and the wonderful liberating effect of education. Didn't realize it, but I had seen a lot of Klansman-style personalities growing up in Western Queensland and ran into them all over the country. They're everywhere around the world. But covering the Klan in 1981 in the Deep South in Atlanta, which is considered the capital of the Deep South until you get over to Mississippi. Covering the Klan there was really interesting because there was a new resurgence in civil rights. It began with Martin Luther King, who was shot in 1968, as you said. In 1981, there were a lot of the old characters like Jesse Jackson and Ambassador Brown and maybe five or six people from the Southern Christian Leadership Conference were starting to become quite prominent as black leaders. And they'd cut their teeth, literally, in Alabama, going up against Bull Connor and the police and the fire hoses and marching on Washington. So when these guys started really standing up and showing the authority of the mature leaders they had become, there was a reaction from the Klan. And the Klan generally consists of people who are not well-educated, who are bigoted, who are frustrated, and they think that generally blacks and Jewish people are getting advantages they should have because they're the original Americans.
There's a mixture of swagger and resentment at the same time.
Absolutely. And the swagger is modified by the fact that most of them wore masks for centuries, since the Civil War. And what was happening in 81 was, under the leadership of a guy called David Duke, they were starting to come out in the open and take the masks off. So the Klan was actually reinventing itself. So when the Klan started coming out of the woodwork, literally onto the streets and marching, again with their face masks up, they're still wearing the pointed sheets and pointed hats and sheets, that was considered a huge threat to civil rights. And so I went out to cover this for CNN, and my first shooter, my first cameraman, was a black college graduate, about 24. And your first job, as you know, Richard, when you go out with a cameraman, especially into a potentially hazardous environment, your first job is to stand in front of the cameraman and keep them safe because they've got their eyepiece up their eye. They're looking through the lens. They can't see anything coming at them if there's something flying in your direction. And so your first job is to look out for them. So I was having a chat to the cameraman. I said, "How do you feel about this?" And he said, "Fine, no problem." I said, "If anything happens, this is what we're going to do." And we had a little SOP that what would happen if it got violent. And so we went up on the side of the street to shoot these guys marching towards us. And there are maybe 100 of them in the white sheets and pointed hats and the banners, the whole nine yards. And further down the street, about 30 meters away from us, were a group of young black guys in their 20s. They appear to be college students just from the way they're dressed and moving around and watching this. I had seen in 1968 older black guys who grew up with lynchings, who knew that their neighbors had been lynched for looking at a white woman. Just for that. I knew a cab driver who said that when he was 12, he and his mates in Mississippi had been called in by the local sheriff who showed them a thumb joint from a black man who'd been lynched two nights before to show them this is what happens if you step out of line. So I knew when guys my age, generation, had grown up with this kind of abject, ingrained fear. Looked at these college students in 1981, there was absolutely no fear at all. This is the power of education. There's no fear in my cameraman. He just took the shots, did the things he needed to do, we did the story, and that began 3 years of covering the Klan's resurgence. Powerful story.
So there you are, you're doing all this really interesting work as a journalist. What on earth sparked your interest in computer programming? It's not like you didn't have enough interesting stuff to do, Peter.
It probably goes back to the gadgets, to Rube Goldberg and the chook trap and the telephone out on the farm in Miles. And when I got to CNN, Ted Turner had spent millions of dollars buying huge computers to store all the news data that was coming in to feed the 24-hour machine. And the guy who was head of IT there was a guy called Rob Brown. And he had all this money. He bought all these great computers. And with a bit of spare cash, he bought an Apple II, which then was a cutting-edge personal computer, desktop.
This is not a Macintosh, is it?
This is before
Mac. This is line-entry computing, wasn't it? Like the old MS-DOS, wasn't it?
Pretty close. And you coded in BASIC. One generation or two generations earlier, BASIC was actually done on punch cards, where each punch card was a line of code. You remember that? So I'd walk past this thing on the way to the studio, and at CNN, we worked all around the clock. We worked, two or three shifts at a time, and they used to have to send us home to have a bath if we smelled bad, because it was just so exciting to be there. And every time between air and going to air in the studio and going back to the cafeteria, I'd walk past this Apple. It was sitting still in this pristine plastic case. And I knew how to compose it, but I didn't know how to code, and it started to bother me. And so, like the washing machine, I figured sooner or later I've got to get inside this thing. And so I went to Rob Brown and said, I really want to know how to use this. He said, give me $10. And so I did, and it was the best $10 I have ever spent.
What did he teach you?
He handed me a manual, and I still have it. It was the AppleSoft Basic Programmer's Guide. It was a ringback binder, and on page one, it told you how to plug the computer into the wall. And I thought, I can do that. And just went from there. And in about 2 weeks... I was starting to write some interesting code, and about 6 weeks I had written a virtual robotics program that actually had a robotic arm on the screen go up, pick a block up, put it on a shelf, and if it didn't put it on properly, it obeyed the laws of physics and gravity, and the block would then fall back towards the ground at 9.8 meters per second acceleration due to gravity, bounce and stand still, and the arm would then have to pick it up again. And the algorithms written in BASIC were... just an interesting start to trying to replicate reality.
What was the thrill like, though, of seeing this virtual arm pick something up and then drop it?
That was a very good question, Richard. I remember the first time I wrote a piece of code that added 1 plus 2 and gave me the result on the screen, in DOS, on command mode. And I remember seeing it come up, and it wasn't much more complex than doing a calculator, but in this case, you actually had to tell the computer how to do it, and thinking... I've just felt a door open. I can go anywhere on the planet with this. Through this door is everything that we have to look forward to.
So where did you take this dinky bit of software you'd written?
I wrote the arm, and then I told a friend of mine who was a doctor, a Harvard doctor, who had very good friends at Georgia Institute of Technology, Georgia Tech. And so she told these guys about this anchor geek who was writing code, and they said, that's interesting, and called me up and invited me over in Atlanta. Went over there and sat down, and they said, bring your program over. And again, you have to be old to remember this, but floppy disks used to be literally floppy. They were Mylar disks, and they were 5 1/4 inches across. And you put them into a drive, and you put one into the top drive, and the A drive and the Apple to kick it up, to boot it up. And then you put the second one in with your code on to run your program. So I took my two floppy drives over to these guys, and they plugged it into their Apple, and they booted it up, and we ran the arm. They said, that's cool. And they said, well, do you think it'd actually run a real arm? And I said, well, as a matter of fact, the control codes for this are actually identical to the control codes for a particular kind of robotic arm, which was just coming on the market then. And they said, we happen to have one of those here. I said, really? Jeez. So they said, do you mind if we try it? I said, no. So they actually wheeled it in on this table, plugged it in, and so help me, it worked.
It moved.
The same control code for the images controlled the arm and made the arm move. And they said, well, we're starting this project. It's a Manhattan project for rehabilitative engineering. And I'd never heard rehabilitative engineering before that moment. And you've got to cast your mind back. This was the dark ages of computing, 1981. They'd never seen anything like a desktop computer before. And somebody in DC decided that if you could use this to help people communicate, you could radically advance rehabilitative engineering and assistive technology. That term was just being coined then. So they said, okay, let's find a VA, a Veterans Administration lab. We'll chuck a bunch of geeks in the room. We'll give them a bunch of money and we'll tell them to go find a solution. And I was invited to join, and my president of news said, no, you can't do it. And I said, why? He said, conflict of interest. And the only time I've ever not done what I've been asked to do by somebody who had authority, I moonlighted.
On the quiet?
Yeah, I went to the lab. I had to become a government employee because you had to be on the payroll to work with patients because of the waiver laws and the control and the protection laws. And so I was I had a U.S. government ID card that said I was a programmer analyst, and we worked in this R&D lab, and that's where it all started.
So by day, you're reporting on international television.
Yeah.
And by night,
I was a geek.
You're a geek perfecting robotic technology.
Yeah, yeah, it's kind of cool.
This is Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio.
My guest today is journalist and inventor Peter Ford. Peter grew up in the Darling Downs of Queensland, became a journalist, joined CNN as a reporter and an anchorman, and while there discovered the world of computer programming and in very little time invented software that could control a bionic arm. And he had to develop this software without his bosses at CNN even knowing, because he was forbidden from doing it on the basis that it might form a conflict of interest. While all this is going on, you're still doing all these international stories, Peter, covering the space program, nuclear talks, and perestroika in Russia. This is the period when Mikhail Gorbachev was the leader in the Soviet Union, as it then was. You actually learned Russian in this time as well. How did you do that?
Well, I had learned a little bit of Russian back in Australia in the 70s. I dated a Russian for a while and had learned some of the language then. And then when I was assigned to go to the Soviet Union, I actually moved on to Miami by that point with the NBC station there as a 6 and 11 news anchor, and decided that if I was going to go to Moscow on assignment, I really wanted to be able to understand the language because it, you know, just gives you huge advantages getting indoors, talking to people, hearing what they're saying when they think you don't know what they're saying. And so I told my station I wanted a Russian teacher, and I wanted to be able to select them. And I found a professor at the University of Miami named Eva Friedel, who was a professor of Soviet studies. And she had grown up in Kiev, the daughter of a very wealthy Jewish merchant before 1917. And as a six-year-old girl, it was forbidden under the Tsarist regime in Russia to teach the serfs to read or write for obvious reasons. They wanted to control them. But Eva, growing up in this very wealthy estate, said she wanted to start a school at the age of six. And so he said, right, so in secret, they started a schoolroom. She taught the serfs' children to read and write Russian. When 1917 came and the Bolsheviks and then the communists froze all their assets and basically put them under house arrest and made them impoverished because they didn't have any money, the servants took them in because their daughter had taught them to read and write. This is Eva. And at about the age of 22, she and her family escaped to Austria, and because they'd had tutors growing up in this privileged environment, they'd learned classical Greek, Latin, science, physics. When they got to Austria, she applied for the School of Medicine, and as a woman in 1922, that was a really unusual, still unusual thing for a woman to go to university, let alone be a doctor. She went to medical school, and she took as an elective this brand new interesting science called psychoanalysis, and her teacher was Sigmund Freud.
What were you doing when the Gulf War broke out, the first Gulf War, when Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait?
I was in Washington. By that stage, I'd gone to NBC in Washington as a news anchor with their owned and operated station. And when the war started to brew, some unusual things happened. One night, we were invited to a dinner in Washington. This is in mid-August 1990, and the then Foreign Minister Ambassador to Washington, Tariq Aziz, invited a number of journalists in, and I came in from NBC, and some guys came in from CNN, some guys I knew from the past, and we sat down to dinner at the embassy.
You had dinner with Saddam Hussein's Foreign Minister?
Right. I think it was the Jack of Spades.
Yeah, that's right. In Washington, on the cusp of the Gulf War.
Yeah, just after they'd invaded and invaded Kuwait.
What were the rules you were expected to adhere to at such a dinner like that?
Well, actually, there's a basic etiquette around the world for this kind of dinner, where if the ambassador or the president or whoever it is invites you in, usually over drinks before and entrees, you talk about the gossip of the day, you know, what's going on and who's being silly. And then over entree and main course, you might start discussing the politics of the day, the business news of the day, what's going on, who's running what. And then just before dessert's served, the host gives a short speech, usually about 3 to 5 minutes, which is the propaganda message of the dinner. And everybody knows that's what you're there to hear. And they'll tell you some nice things about themselves and their country and what they're planning to do and how they're not a threat to anyone. Then you have dessert. And then you have coffee and liqueur at the end, and that's when you hear the real gossip and the stuff that you, that's supposed to be off the record. And that's pretty standard everywhere.
What was Tariq Aziz's speech like that night?
Well, he had a fairly difficult sell because he had to explain why his boss had just invaded another sovereign nation, Kuwait, and threatened oil supplies. And most importantly, he was moving towards the border of Saudi Arabia. And the story, the word was, the buzz was coming out of the Gulf, was he wanted to go all the way down to the Horn of Africa and control everything. Saddam, who knew what he was thinking, but Tariq Aziz's story was that Saddam was actually a great peacemaker.
Yes.
And he was coming out of Baghdad / Babylon / the head of the center of the Byzantine Empire / the extension of what was the Assyrian Empire. So he was really the pointed end of inevitable history and dynastic destiny.
All right, he was just reassembling some natural order of things.
Exactly.
That was, so his, that was
Arab,
his line
how
of
could
argument.
You resist? Yeah.
Right, yeah, this is the way that it's meant to be, right?
That's
yeah.
right. And the backstory with it that really wasn't publicized in America was that everybody hated the Kuwaitis. If you go to the Gulf and talk to an Arab on the ground, and I don't mean to offend anybody, I'm just reporting the news here, but if you went down there, a lot of Arabs around Kuwait would say that they were just shell farmers, oyster shell farmers.
Peasants, right, yes.
Yeah, who came in off the desert and discovered that they could sell oyster shells for the calcium, for lime, and they happened to discover oil.
So they're rich bogans in the eyes of the more sophisticated Arab exactly. civilizations nearby, in other words.
Exactly. So there were quite a lot of Arabs who weren't saying this publicly, but the national leaders who were quite happy that somebody was giving what for to the Kuwaitis. But in the terms of geopolitical propaganda and power balance, because Saddam was out of control, or thought to be out of control, and was threatening Saudi, who was a great friend of the United States, this suddenly became a matter of enormous importance for Washington. So Tariq Aziz's job was to try and hose everyone down by starting with the media. So he told us Saddam Hussein was a great peacemaker, that he was going to bring erudition and education and enlightenment to the Arab peoples of the Gulf.
How was that greeted? With polite silence or laughter or
oh, no,
or
you
what?
Never laugh at events like this. It's a dance. It was very polite. We asked polite questions. For example, how far is President Saddam going to extend his enlightenment? Is it going to go to Saudi Arabia or Yemen or any of the other countries downrange? I had a brother living in at that stage in Oman in the oil business, and I was actually interested in the outcome myself. We'd actually set up a plan of what to do if Saddam did go down that far and how we'd get the family out. So that was Tariq Aziz's job, and in 5 minutes he delivered that message to us, and then we had dessert and heard the real gossip over coffee.
What was the real gossip? Can you remember?
No, really. It's like all gossip. It's pretty ephemeral. Okay. And has a lifespan of about 3 days.
You went into report on Desert Storm. Where were you based? The invasion?
Desert Shield. We went in first. And my cameraman was... I was ex-3RAR, and my cameraman was ex-101st Airborne. So when we went in, we flew in on a C-141 with the US Air Force. We had very good relations with the media because we did a lot of good stories with them and with the Pentagon. So we flew in on a C-141 in webbing seats, and anybody who's flown in webbing seats will know how much
great.
Fun that is.
Yeah.
And we landed in what was then called an undisclosed airbase, which is actually Dhahran Air Base, up near the border of Saudi Arabia and Kuwait. But we go out into the desert, and we meet the U.S. units, and we talk to their officer, the commanding officer or the OC, and then we talk to their IO, their intelligence officer, let him know that we're... spoke the same language, and then they turn us loose. And we actually heard a lot of stories we didn't put to air because they were tactically secure. And we got a lot of great stories because we were getting there first.
Saddam was a more or less, by the region said, secular leader. He wasn't an Islamist by any means. Did you see signs of the kind of burgeoning Islamism in the region at the time?
That's a very good question, Richard. Yes. And in 2020 hindsight, I didn't realize what I was seeing at the time, but in 2020 hindsight, I realized what we were looking at. Around about the 20s and 30s, the House of Saud in Saudi Arabia formed what some might say was an unholy alliance with the Wahhabist Islamist leaders in that part of the country.
These are real hardliners, yeah.
They are, yeah. And what happened was, essentially, the royal family, the House of Saud, decided that to keep things quiet and peaceful, if they let the Wahhabis control religious conduct in the country, that everything would stay nice and quiet. And it did for decades. And usually when we went into countries, and still happens, usually you get a gopher, and the gopher is probably a local university student who speaks your language and knows where everything is and who to connect you to so he can get your stories quickly. And they're usually pretty friendly. You end up, you know, getting to know them, meeting their families. And very often you get them out of the country at the end of a story if they've been in a dangerous position. In Saudi, when we landed, all we saw was resentment. Very well-dressed, very well-educated Saudis looking at us with barely disguised resentment, even hatred. We thought that was kind of strange. We thought maybe it was because the US forces were letting a lot of their troops, who were women, go in country in T-shirts, which is uniform T-shirts. They were driving trucks, forklifts. They were doing all kinds of stuff that they found highly offensive. And the Americans were basically saying, well, we're here to liberate you, you know, get used to it, which probably wasn't the most diplomatic approach. And there was this huge resentment from Saudis who believed that their own forces could protect them from Saddam. They didn't need U.S. intervention. And they certainly didn't need these infidels coming in and flaunting women and all the things that offended them personally. You don't have to agree with that philosophy to understand the anger and resentment they had at what they felt was being personally offensive in their own country.
You had to go for a while in between all of this, writing the great Australian novel in the central desert of Australia. How did that pan out?
It's interesting because going back to Saudi again, I actually have an enormous affinity for deserts. There's a wonderful place that you find in deserts. And desert people are very similar. Going around the empty quarter in Saudi Arabia, I ran into Bedouins out in the central desert who were very like our old elders out in the central desert in Australia here, because they've learned to accommodate and life and conditions in the desert. They have very strong spiritual beliefs. So going to the central desert in Australia, I found a lot of the same old personalities, those same characters. And I'd been raised as a kid by my father to have enormous respect for Aboriginal culture, for their beliefs. And in writing the book, I felt the best place to start was out there talking to them.
So you met a man called Yami Lester.
Yeah.
How hard was it to get to meet him?
He was hard. It was Yami Ngintaka Lester. He's a Parenti dreaming man. And so I did the manuscript back to front. I did all the research. I went through archaeological records. I read an account by Professor Roland and Catherine Burnt, two professors of anthropology at the University of Western Australia. Read a lot of records about stories and then went out into the desert to talk to some of the old fellows. And I'd met some of them years earlier and wrote the book. And the book, it was an attempt to tell an absolutely accurate story about the belief structures and why they're so important and why they're so powerful. So I wrote the novel and then I published it myself. I shopped it around here in Australia and didn't have any success. And so I published it myself and I published 1,000 hardback copies. Two copies went to the National Library in Canberra, bought out these copies, was starting to release them, and thought, look, I'll just go and check to see if I haven't made any mistakes.
I think that's wise, isn't it? I mean, because you're a guy who's an outsider, essentially, trying to tell these stories.
Oh, yeah.
And they're also not your stories.
Yeah, and I was really aware of the fact, too, as a white fella going to tell his story, I was always aware that that was what I was as an outsider, and I tried to make as many good contacts and credible contacts to get permissions to do these. All the guys I knew, all the elders I knew, said, you've got to talk to Yami. And Yami was somewhere between the South Australian border, his home in Amala, and up in Alice Springs, and sometimes out at Uluru. It took me 3 months. Yami would say, oh, look, yes, I'd love to talk to you. And then he'd say, call me back. And I'd call him back a week later, and he's gone. He's somewhere else. So I called Yami again, and somebody said, oh, Yami's gone to Wallatina. And that was further down the track. So I called him up at Wallatina station and said, I'm coming. And he finally said, all right. So he said, get off the train at Marla. So I got on the GAN, and in the middle of the night, in the middle of the desert, got the GAN to stop and let me off. And the conductor came down and said, you sure you want to get off here? Middle of nowhere. And I said, yes, I'm meeting somebody. He said, you sure? And the conductor had no idea what was going on there. I said, yes. So he said, fine. And it was like he was covering himself for the inquest later if the body turned
up. Yeah, the bleached bones of Peter right. Ford end up, tragic death of journalist and inventor Peter Ford somewhere in central Australia.
Right.
Yes.
So he finally let me off the train, pitch dark. The train goes away, and there's something really wonderful in the desert. I love the desert anyway, but when the train went away, you could hear the last, long after the train was gone, you could hear the rails resonating. That last little sound of steel, and by that stage it was miles down the track. And there was nothing but blazing stars, black sky, blazing stars. And I'm standing there thinking, well, this is kind of cool. And I stood a bit longer, it was very quiet. I could hear animals moving in the bushes. And then I heard behind me, are you Peter? And it was an Arenta man who was a friend of Yami's, and he'd been parked there for like 3 hours waiting. He was just standing there. And we got into a four-wheel drive and drove further off into the desert, and I met Yami at breakfast. And that was when I met one of the most wonderful people I've had the joy of meeting. Yeah. I said to Yami, I want to check the stories. And so he said, well, we have to sit down. And sitting down meant we actually sat down around a fire, and he brought in another elder from the central desert. A very old fellow, very imposing fellow, who was known as Kumanara. And Kumanara is a name somebody takes when somebody else with their same name passes away. And they can no longer say the name out loud, so they take the word in the central desert, Kumanara. And this was an old fellow, a storykeeper from the deep desert. And he and Yami and I sat down. He didn't speak English, or ostensibly didn't. And Yami, who was blind, would hear me read to him from the book, and then pass it on to the old fellow. And between them, the two old fellows decided whether or not I could use certain stories. As it turned out, all stories I'd written were accurate, which was a great relief to me. The problem was there were three elements in there which were considered taboo. And I had said, well, I got these from the anthropological records, and that's when one of them let me know they believe that the anthropologist stole stories. So they asked me not to publish, and I said, well, the book's already out. And Yami said, if they think, meaning the other old fellows, that I let you, meaning Yami, let you, meaning me, publish it, they will kill me. And I thought, he really means this. Not me, him. And he really believes this. And I thought, there's only one thing to do. So I pulled the book off the market, called the library, National Library in Canberra, and told the two curators, two young women who were very good, who wrote the gold standard for putting taboo books in storage. They took it off the main register. They sealed them, shrink sealed them, put them in the vault, and they're only accessible by elders of the Yankunstjara people, which I thought was wonderful for two city girls.
So you rewrote it?
Then I rewrote the book. Then I went back to the desert and read it to Yami again. And the second time I read the whole thing. And I have to tell you, to sit down around at a fire in the middle of the desert telling a story is an amazingly primal and powerful experience. It was one of the great storytelling experiences I've had as a journalist. And
was he all right with it then?
Second time around, yeah. He cleared it, and I did it on tape, and he approved it, and he's in the acknowledgements, and he's become a wonderful friend. He's just an amazingly brave warrior.
Let's get back to the inventing now, because you're still working on your code. Obviously, the kind of work you were doing in robotics, meanwhile encoding, was going to affect people with motor neurone disease like Stephen Hawking. And what did he say when he saw your software and tried it out?
Well, this is kind of famous, and it was a terrible secret I kept to myself until recently, but I always thought it was going to be an interesting story. He looked at it the first time, and I wired him up, and he got this disdainful look on his face and signaled me with his other program, said, your software's no good.
Oh, really?
So I was thinking, I think this is one of those moments where you either pack everything up and go home and do something totally different, or you say, well, you know, blow this, I'm going to.
He's cantankerous, though, isn't he? I mean, you know, he's a genius.
He has a distinctive personality, yeah.
Yeah.
But I used that as a stimulus to just write better code. And 4 months later, 3 months later, he emailed me in Australia and said, can you come to Texas? I want you to put this technology onto it. It was to the effect he wanted us to load the technology onto the wheelchair. So it sounded like all was forgiven. He thought the software might be okay after all. He was at the time tapping tapping a hand switch. And in fact, at one stage, to show him how good NeuroSwitch was, I wired up the same arm he was using to pressed the switch, the same arm you used, and said, now make a signal with your hand switch. And he made the signal. And I said, look at the signal on the screen the way you just looked at your signal. I said, now don't touch the switch, make a signal with your arm, just using the signal. And it was 10% of the effort he needed to press the hand switch. And this only the first time up in our relationship at that point, his eyebrows went up. And he actually looked interested and thought, ah, this is interesting. This is something.
Now we come to your involvement with Neil Armstrong.
I'm going to step off the land now. It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
The transcript of that is, it's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
The original transcript.
Yes. You thought the whole world had it wrong. Why?
First of all, I wasn't arrogant enough to think that the world was wrong. And also, for linguists who may want to leap onto the web or Twitter or emails, hold your fire, because linguists were very upset about what I'm about to tell you, probably with good professional reason. I was out in Fairbourne, where I was working, and which is where the Wright brothers used to fly their aircraft. It was a great place to invent stuff. And one weekend, I was out riding. I have a mountain bike out there. I go riding, and I was riding to a local coffee shop. And for some reason or other, riding past where the Wright brothers were flying, which is now Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, I was thinking, you know, the greatest piece of flying ever by our species was when Neil Armstrong landed on the moon. He actually took over from the computer and landed it on rockets in a boulder field where the rocks were the size of buses and could have lost the entire mission, meaning they would die, and landed incredibly calmly. And his pulse never went up above 148. I've got a printout. And so in this whole process, I thought, you know, a guy who made that amazing landing, who had done amazing things in other earlier missions around the Earth, for which he was awarded, when he landed, would not have messed up something as simple as that, when he knew what he was saying was going to go into history.
Because he was supposed to say, it's one small step for a man, wasn't
that's right.
it?
Yeah, exactly.
But that's not what we're hearing there, is it? Or not what we seem to be hearing.
What you think you're hearing is the A has disappeared. And I thought a couple of things. First of all, he comes from Northern Ohio, where it's a little bit like Western Queensland, where vowels become almost an elective. You know, you don't always have to use them. And having been a news anchor, having to learn to speak with an American accent and having to do voice work, as you do, and you know how sometimes if you're tired, things don't always come out the way you plan them to. I thought, this guy was such a precise pilot, and he got everything so right. He must have got this right, because he also wrote the lines. He wrote the lines while they were sitting on the moon waiting for permission to step out. And later on when we met, he told me how he wrote them on sitting in the module with Buzz Aldrin, how he wrote them down. And like an engineer, linearly thinking, he said, well, you know, I'm stepping off the ladder and that's a small step and it's a big leap for mankind. So that's
what it, so what, when you met him and spoke with him, as you had done several times as a journalist, what did he say he'd said as he went down that
well moment? The way we got to meet this time was one-on-one, because in this little coffee shop I downloaded the voice track from the NASA site.
It's one small step for man,
and I'd heard it many times.
One giant leap for mankind.
I heard it when he actually did it. And then I downloaded a $40 voice editing program, and I pulled it down, and I looked at the sound waves, and I thought, there's something there where the A occurs, and I think it's an A. And I think because of his accent and his background and all the other things that are going on, you don't hear the A. And so I wrote this little piece and stuck it on my website. The Houston Chronicle picked it up, ran with it. Every newspaper in the world started picking it up, and at the same time, I contacted an old friend at NASA, Hugh Harris, who's the voice of NASA. You would have heard him calling shuttle launches. And said, look, I've got something here that Mr. Armstrong might like to know about. So Neil Armstrong sent me an email. We arranged to meet. We met at the Air and Space Museum. He sent an email just before we met saying, look, if I get there early and you're not here, I'll be standing around the lunar lander. He's the most modest man in the world, but that was a heck of a throwaway line.
People would be going, is that Neil Armstrong? No, it couldn't be, could it?
So he sat down, and before, you know, I'd interview him in groups of space journos. We were all space junkies, but this time it was one-on-one. We were just talking as geeks. I didn't touch – he didn't even know I'd been a journalist. And I said, this is what we want to do. We talked about the microphones inside his spacesuit. We talked about the acoustics. We talked about the transmissions. We talked about it coming in through Australia, through Honeysuckle Creek, and, you know, the great dish story about how we got the signal back. And we talked about how that letter could have become obscured and how he actually sat sat in the lunar excursion module on the surface of the moon before he was given clearance by mission control to step out and wrote those lines, and how he wrote one small step for a man, one giant leap for mankind, and how he believed when he stepped off. That's what he said.
It's one small step for man.
What's your hope for this new technology you've invented, this neuroswitch technology?
I think as a species we're on a threshold that is being contributed to, whose structure is being contributed to by a massive convergence of diverse technologies and discoveries. Nanotechnology, genetics, the whole idea that through various ways of science fiction and our own experience with things like laptops, that we are becoming more and more closely aligned with machine intelligence. We are going to find our intelligence challenged by advanced computers, and we can choose to ally with that and use that to enhance our own experience as humans. The short answer is, I think we're inevitably going to become bionic. We already are. You know, my father had not just a pacemaker, a defibrillator that kept him alive. We have people with Parkinson's who have brain stimulation systems. We have all kinds of fusion pumps for people with diabetes. So we're already starting to live with machinery that supports us. We're becoming bionic.
What are our smartphones, if anything, but bionic technology? I mean, they're almost always in our hands. Yeah. They might as well be attached to us.
There you go. The cochlear ear implant is classic bionics. It doesn't take much to put a phone chip in there and start becoming a walking telephone system.
Peter, now that you've become a very successful international journalist, published author, a inventor of bionics technology, are you thinking about trying brain surgery after all for a bit of fun, just to moonlight on that for a while?
I think if I had it all over again, that would be an attractive line of work, yeah. But I leave it to the great neurologists like Professor Dominic Rowe to do that.
There just wasn't enough time. Amazing hearing about your extraordinary life. Thank you so much for being my guest, Peter.
Thank you for having me, Richard. It's been a great pleasure.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more information and interviews, visit abc.net.au/conversations.